Welcome to Talk Nation Radio as we continue our discussion with journalist, author, and producer Edward Girardet. I'm Dory Smith. We're discussing his 2011 book, Killing the Cranes, a reporter's journey through three decades of war in Afghanistan, out from Chelsea Green Press. The book has a section on U.S. support for Osama bin Laden and his support for the anti-Soviet Afghan resistance, as well as his relationship with the Taliban and his escape from Tora Bora. There are also fascinating pages about Edward Girardet's own confrontation with bin Laden, who asked him who he is and what he's doing in Afghanistan. Saying he's a journalist covering the region, Girardet said, quote, "I'll leave if our Afghan friends no longer consider us their guests, just as I'm sure you'll leave if they no longer consider you their guests." Bin Laden tells him, quote, "We're here because of Allah. The Afghans are our brothers of Islam, but we are here to fight all our enemies, Americans, Russians, Israelis." What follows is a fascinating exchange between a journalist and a militant about intentions, identities, and loyalties. Edward Girardet is the founding director of the Institute for Media and Global Governance in Geneva, Switzerland. He's also the editor of Crosslines Essential Media, LTD. And we continue now with my question about Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. About Osama bin Laden, I know you have written that his death didn't really leave the kind of void that the U.S. might have hoped it would in terms of violence or any kind of terrorist impact in the region. But what did his death do, if anything? I mean, I think Americans think of that part of the world. They think of getting bin Laden. Okay, we did that. Let's go. Maybe others wonder, you know, on a deeper level. I mean, let's say, for example, if there were something like a Loya Jirga, would Al-Qaeda even be there? I mean, would they be represented today, or is that how it works?
No. A Loya Jirga has got to include only Afghans. They may be people in the pay of someone else. That's a different issue. But it's not for foreigners. And don't forget, you know, Afghans also regard the Arabs, the Al-Qaeda types, just as they regard the Pakistanis, the Americans, the Germans, as foreigners. They don't trust them. And although they may like you as an individual, they always suspect that you're there for a different agenda. So I think if you're looking at the future, the Loya Jirga concept is probably one of the only ones that will work, although it may take several Loya Jirgas. And then also comes the matter of who has the right to be there. I mean, during 2002, when they had the first big Loya Jirga in Kabul, Khalilzad and the UN actually let the warlords come in and take part in the Jirga, and they threatened people, and particularly the women. And I think people were dismayed because they suddenly realized there's nothing new. Once again, someone's come in and they're trying to impose from the outside. And, you know, Khalilzad or the Americans may have thought they were doing the right thing, but they were meddling with something that they did not understand. And the result is that, you know, the U.S., the Germans, the Brits, NATO may have thought they could work more efficiently with the warlords because they had the power. They were, in fact, undermining a lot of this goodwill and fervor. When I say fervor, I mean enthusiasm for the future, that finally, you know, the war was coming to an end. And, you know, I met a lot of women, for example, in Western Afghanistan when I went out there with Ahmed Rashid, the Anglo-Pakistani writer of the book The Taliban. We met women who seemed delighted that finally it was their turn to have a say. They'd never had a say before. And, you know, some of the women after 2002 became very disillusioned and became even more disillusioned as time went on. Some have stuck it out, but, you know, they lost their lives at the same time. They've been killed off. Anyone who speaks out or is considered to be a danger is bumped off one way or another by one side or the other.
You have also mentioned in your book trafficking of women. Who was responsible for that?
Oh, I mean, this has been going on for a long time. The trafficking which I came across was really during the Soviet era, when the wives and daughters of communist officers were basically taken out by the Mujahideen and sold to the Arabs, and they disappeared somewhere. And secondly, during the Talib era, they forced a lot of women to marry Taliban, and that's also still happening today. There's a lot of kidnapping going on. Women are disappearing. Boys are disappearing as well, children. It's something which, you know, we know is happening, very difficult to keep track of. But the trafficking involves, you know, everything from opium to weapons to children to women. It's all big business. And I think the problem now with Afghanistan is that there is so much money to be made, money from the military machine, money from drugs, money from international aid. Money has been thrown at Afghanistan, and there are these highly privileged elites that have learned how to use and abuse this funding. Not all of them, and there's some, obviously, who really are sincere about trying to rebuild Afghanistan. But right now, you know, you make what you can and get out.
Americans, again, may not know any of these details, but they have heard in general that there are various regional concerns and interests in Afghanistan and that people go back and forth between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Let's say the United States does withdraw or, you know, downsize its presence in the region. Maybe NATO does too. Who does that leave, you know, strong in the region right now? Just, you know, regionally speaking, I mean, what forces are going to be increasing therefore?
We're seeing a whole new picture of what was known as the Great Game, and still is the Great Game in many ways, whereby the Pakistanis, for one, they have their own game to play. Their interest is not Afghanistan, ironically, it's India. But they see Afghanistan as being part of the front toward India. Right now, the Indians and the Russians are investing much more heavily in Afghanistan. I mean, the Indians have really stepped up their investment in Afghanistan. So, of course, for the Pakistanis, this is a threat. The Indians are now emerging on their western flank, not just the eastern. So that's one concern. And the Pakistanis want to have Afghanistan as a country that will run along with its own policies, hence the need to search in one way or another a Pashtun-dominated government. And that's why ISI has always, from the very beginning, the 1980s, has always pushed Pakistan's agenda, which we were quite happy to go along with. The CIA was, you know, relied on ISI for the bulk of its intelligence during the 1980s and 90s, and now it's still happening. I mean, just to go back to the killing of bin Laden, and, you know, a lot of us who have followed Afghanistan closely over the years were quite amused, in a sense, by the denials of the Pakistani government that they knew nothing about bin Laden. I mean, it's, you know, to me, there's absolutely no question that elements of ISI did not know where bin Laden was. I mean, he was basically living in a house, you know, 500 yards from what was equivalent of West Point. And I can tell you, when we went through the tribal areas, the Pakistanis always knew where we were. I mean, we probably deluded ourselves into thinking that we had managed to sneak across, which we did, but very often it's just because we were slightly faster than the police. So to say that they did not know is astounding, but of course they were given a way out, basically, but no one believes it. So Pakistan has a very profound role, and it's not going to give up that role at all. Russia, ironically, is now moving in a big way. During the 1990s, toward the end of Massoud's, you know, reign, basically he was being supported by the Indians and the Russians, and these are both his erstwhile enemies. Russia is also very much concerned by the whole opium trade in Afghanistan. The bulk of the opium from Afghanistan is now passing through Eastern Europe or Russia. I think now the Russians have the highest number of heroin addicts in Europe, so that's one concern. But at the same time, there are many former KGB people, the Russian intelligence people, Soviet intelligence people, who during the Soviet war, they made their contacts with Afghans, and they were also involved in trafficking of opium and heroin, and they are still involved with it. It's a huge business. When we look at the pipelines now, the plans to build a pipeline through Afghanistan to Pakistan and India, the pipeline itself has to go through areas and will probably serve as a conduit for drugs as well. And also there are quite a few foreign, what we call foreign contractors. These are Americans, Europeans, whatnot, who do all the contracting for the U.S. military or for NATO, bringing in supplies. We know, and I know that, you know, the FBI is looking into this, there are a number of American citizens who are also involved in this trafficking. I mean, they have a very natural way of getting the stuff out because they're bringing in, you know, Evian bottled water for the troops, and they can take out what they like. Iran, of course, has always had its interests. They're on the western border of Afghanistan. They've traditionally supported the Shia minority, the Hazaras, who live in the central highlands of Afghanistan. And they're not going to drop Afghanistan either. And then China is another one. You know, China is now investing massively in Afghanistan, but in its way. It's investing in this huge copper mine in northern Afghanistan. It's the world's largest copper mine. And we all know that the way they're going to do it is the way they've been operating in Africa, i.e. bringing in all their own people, from truck drivers to cooks to engineers, and will deal with their copper mining in a manner which cuts it off for the rest of the country. They'll have probably security fences all around. And there are Afghans who, when they have the time, are actually concerned about the environment. And they're worried that the Chinese will just pollute the rivers, and because they're not going to bother with any niceties of trying to prevent environmental damage. So you have all these factors of people in Afghanistan for themselves.
Now, Iran would support, I believe, Hekmat Yar, and yet on the other side of things, the more secret side of things, the United States would be dealing with whoever is going to help them secure this Caspian and Central Asia region pipeline, right?
And right. That, the Iranians, of course, want to have their own pipeline. Obviously, Afghanistan should have a government that has the ability to control whatever happens on its territory, whether it's a pipeline or railroad or development aid or investment. But right now, so many people are in so many other people's pockets that the bulk of the population, the ordinary Afghans, I mean, they're no dummies. They're actually quite well informed. They know. They listen to the BBC. They listen to the Voice of America. They listen to other radio stations. And in fact, the local Afghan media has been actually quite forthright. So they're aware now of what's going on, and they also know that they themselves have absolutely no control over this. So they, in a sense, Afghanistan is much more for sale today than it was, say, 10 or 15 years ago.
And where would Osama bin Laden have factored into all of this? Can you picture, let's say, from decades ago forward, what would his position have been in all of this? Because it almost looks as if that pipeline region involving India, Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, you know, just really shapes up to be potentially a major regional conflict that could go on for another three decades or more.
Yeah. I think probably bin Laden didn't really care about earthly matters in that way. I think he, when he first came to Afghanistan, which is right at the beginning of the 1980s, he actually came as an aid worker, if you want to call him that way. He had come to help the Afghans with the jihad. Initially, he brought in, or he helped fund, you know, humanitarian relief for the refugees. In fact, that's what most of the Arabs were doing. They were helping the refugees. But then it began to change with investment in madrasas, in Islamic schools, and then weaponry for the more extremists of the Mujahid groups. And then he began to bring his own people in. He wasn't the only player, by the way. There were other Arabs on their own as well. But they basically came in, these foreign jihadists, because Afghanistan during the 80s was the only jihad going in the entire world. It was the only place they could feel they could go to, and they could fight against the infidel, who were the Soviets. But also, they made no bones about what they thought about Americans or Europeans. So their long-term goal was clearly more of a global one, but they were using Afghanistan as one. Now, from the Afghan point of view, there were a number of Afghan commanders or politicians with the resistance who had studied in the Middle East, in Cairo. They were more familiar with what the Arabs were doing, but your average Afghan actually detested the Arabs because they were extremely arrogant. They also claimed to the face to many Afghans that they were not proper Muslims because they were not Muslims in the right way. And, you know, you don't tell an Afghan that he's not a Muslim. You know, they don't like to be criticized that way, and they do consider themselves to be Muslim, but they're much more laissez-faire about it. Secondly, the Arabs came with a lot of money, and quite a few of the commanders realized that the Arabs were trying to buy their way into the resistance, sending their own people. And again, you know, during the late 80s, a lot of the Afghans thought the Arabs were crazy, diwana, as they called them, because they wanted to die fighting the infidel. And in those days, you didn't have the concept of a suicide bomber. I mean, Afghans did not want to get killed in the war. They were quite happy to fight, but they did not want to get killed. And they thought, well, if these crazy Arabs come in, then fine, let them do that. And if they're going to pay us money, fine, that's even better. But all that began to change when they began trying to impose their own version of the Islamic new man, which did not go down well with many Afghans. So during the early 90s, people like Abdul Haq and other commanders kicked out the Arabs, but they came back again in 1996 with the Taliban, and of course from thence onwards they could operate as they wanted to. The Taliban didn't really have a close eye over them. In fact, most Taliban had no idea what they were doing, and also remained separate from Al-Qaeda, the Al-Qaeda elements. I mean, the Taliban had their own camps, but Al-Qaeda had their own bases as well. And Al-Qaeda began to bring in their own foreign fighters, you know, from Chechnya, from Yemen, and they just thought this is an opportunity to take part in the war. And by the time 9/11 happened, there were thousands of Pakistani Taliban, including military assets such as officers who flew aircraft against the North, and you know there is a lot of evidence about this. Also, the U.S. forces, when they came in, they had to give the Pakistanis, ISI, 3 days to fly out all their own people from the airport in Kunduz in the North. That was the arrangement. You can get out, and then once you're out, that's it. So the Pakistanis flew out thousands of their own people, and others crossed the border during this, you know, 3-4 day hiatus when things were not yet organized after the U.S. intervention. So I think a lot of the Al-Qaeda types really just saw Afghanistan as a playground to get themselves organized. But there was always the suspicion by the Afghans that they were here not for Afghanistan, but for themselves. And finally, prior to the events of 9/11, Massoud, Abdul Haq, and other commanders, these former resistance commanders, were organizing a new front of Afghans against the Taliban. And this consisted of quite a few disenchanted Taliban who disliked the Arabs, disliked the Mullah Omar types from Kandahar because they felt it was no longer their country. And this was beginning to move. And in fact, the Taliban were actually in a process of imploding. And that's why when I go back to saying that it was an unnecessary war, had there been more of an astute perception of what was going on in Afghanistan at the time, in October 2001, then, you know, the U.S. could have perhaps focused more on just some police or special forces type operations to, you know, arrest or kill, I guess, the senior Taliban people who were the ones who were closely operating with Al-Qaeda. But the majority were not. They were, you know, uneducated, illiterate Afghans who really had no idea except what they heard on the radio.
And under that circumstance, would we have known who to target? I mean, would that list have existed, if you will? Because
yeah, the information was there. I mean, there were quite a few, particularly former resistance people, who had volunteered to say, we'll help track these people down. There were a lot of tribal leaders who had been supporting the Taliban, but then realized that this had gone too far. And you also have to remember that people were tired of war. I mean, people were extremely tired of war. And suddenly this looked like an opportunity. And I think even people who disliked Massoud, when they heard of his assassination, that shocked them a lot. So I think with good intelligence, and there were quite a few aid workers who'd been working in Afghanistan, even under the Taliban, they were saying the same thing, saying, you know, we know who to deal with. We know who is the, quote, the good Talib commander and who is not the good Talib commander. So, you know, quite a few of the aid agencies, like the Swedish Committee for Afghanistan or Madeira, which is a French agricultural group, they never used labels. They always said, we deal with Mohammed so-and-so. Okay, he's working with the Taliban, but we know him to be a good man. And he actually favors schools for girls or favors clinics. So that's how they worked. The intelligence was there, but no one really, or rather the Bush administration wanted all this to happen very quickly. There had to be a massive punishment in a sense. And by, you know, incurring this punishment, they were already in the process of starting a new war. And, you know, when I talk to friends in the States about this, they say, yes, but you don't understand. 9/11 happened. We had to respond. Then you say, well, as a good journalist or someone who's informed a policymaker, you've got to look ahead. You just can't start a new war for reasons of political expedience.
And you do mention quite a bit about the poppy fields in your book, too, not to be underestimated. Mm-hmm. And I found myself wondering just now, as you were speaking about the Bush administration, what was the guiding force behind their policy decisions? I mean, were there economic factors having to do with the pipeline and oil? Were there partnerships already existing at that point with oil interests that pushed this forward? Or were there other economic interests, or did it have to do with, you know, geopolitics? I mean, what was the biggest influence, do you think, on Bush and Cheney at that time?
There was certainly very strong oil interest during the 1990s with the Taliban and the other groups, when you had Unocal and Bridas, which was the Argentinian company, trying to also broker an arrangement. And the oil factor was very, very strong. You know, not forgetting that Cheney actually gave a grant of $43 million to the Taliban in April 2001 in return for supposedly cracking down on opium production. Now, what's interesting is that the Taliban did indeed crack down on opium production, but when you look at the figures and look exactly what happened, what they were doing was they were afraid that the prices would drop because there was too much opium in the market. So some analysts argue, well, in fact, what they were doing was assuring that there would be a good market and high prices for opium, that they were going to hoard the opium in order to have higher prices later on. But anyway, they did get rewarded by Cheney with a direct grant. And, you know, what I find rather ironic is that there was a favoring of having a very stable government in Afghanistan, even if it was a Talib government, because this allowed one then to enter into alliances or agreements for oil reasons with the Taliban. And, you know, while a lot of them, you know, liked the idea of the Northern Alliance, they also just wanted to have a government with which they could deal. And I think this was some of these people with these companies who later came in, by the way, post-2001, 2002, these private contracting firms. I mean, they were basically, you know, friends of the president and friends of the vice president and made fortunes. And I think this is an area which really, really needs to be looked into, to the extent of which public funding, you know, taxpayer funds in Afghanistan were totally ripped off by these companies. I mean, there are numerous examples, but it really would need some very heavy and severe investigative reporting.
And perhaps another book by Edouard Girardet. I want to ask finally, you know, back in the time frame of the early 90s, I was reporting on an organization that had been active in the Balkans to some extent, and then also worked in Afghanistan with the Mujahideen, and this would have been AmeriCares on the board.
Yeah.
You know, sat, of course, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and also, you know, many others, very powerful political figures and also economic ones. And so you talk about money that was flowing, and I think of them. I can recall interviewing them after they announced a major aid delivery agreement with three of the warring factions in the war-torn Bosnian region, right? And I, of course, was at that time working for a CBS affiliate in Connecticut. I called them right up and I said, who's it with? And of course, you know, silence. It turned out that they would admit to me eventually that the aid agreement was not with any warring parties. It was actually made with the Knights of Malta. Strange admission, kind of. They were including in their brochures descriptions of the Mujahideen of Afghanistan as freedom fighters. So then now you're talking about sort of the ancestry, if you will. This would have been George H.W. Bush, you know, having the kinds of friendships and partnerships to make everything work that, you know, then later George W. Bush and Dick Cheney would acquire or would develop on their own.
Well, you know, there are examples of, again, I was often invited by the Council on Foreign Relations during the early months of 2002 just to take part in these global discussions by telephone. I was in Pakistan at the time and going back and forth. And these are mainly people, you know, journalists, aid workers, people who had known Afghanistan for a long time. And we were just discussing what should be done with Afghanistan. How could you have a recovery process that really would make a difference? And there was a lot of interesting comment that was emerging from that because they were quite similar. People saying, you know, go slow and don't throw massive amounts of funding. Be very careful where your funding goes. Work with local communities. It's much more tiresome to work with local communities, but that's the most effective way. And I'll give you one example. The roads, the highways. USAID was funding the rebuilding, the asphalting, basically, of the main highway between Kabul and Kandahar, which is now a beautiful highway. It's smooth asphalt. The problem is they went in with foreign subcontractors, I think they were Turkish, to build the road with bulldozers and do it quickly. And I remember talking to this senior engineer coordinator with USAID, and I said, well, how can you build the road like this? Why aren't you talking with the villagers? What they need are picks and shovels, not bulldozers, and you've got to get them involved. And he said, oh, we haven't got time for that. And I said, but you will never be able to use this road unless you involve the local communities. And this would have meant drinking tea probably for 3 or 4 months with all the villages along the way and basically convincing them that the road was in their interest and would they be prepared to work on the road. They would be paid. It would bring them some form of cash. Don't forget, many of these were farmers who had no cash whatsoever in order to buy things like sugar or tea. They basically were subsistence farmers. So here is the chance to make a bit of extra cash, which would have carried them through for buying extra things such as radios, batteries, you know, do something for the villages. But no one bothered to do that. So the villages were angered. The road was built quickly by Afghan standards, but has never been a safe road. No one travels that road unless you want to get kidnapped or shot or killed along the way. So the road in many ways is useless. I mean, you know, people are using it, but extremely high risk. Now, if they had bothered to involve the communities, which is what a lot of the NGOs have been doing, they sit down for months on end discussing potential projects, even as simple as building, you know, digging a well, they would have avoided this. But, you know, the money had to be spent. It had to be done by outside contractors. So you had people coming in on massive salaries who knew nothing about Afghanistan. I've met, you know, scores of these people. They'd all done a bit of reading, and they said, this is the way it's going to be. You know, massive overheads for the companies, very little which actually filtered down into Afghanistan. So a lot of this supposed aid has never actually made it to Afghanistan. It's bolstered the companies, you know, in Washington and elsewhere. And maybe this is what one's supposed to do with taxpayer funds. I don't think so. But the fact is, the aid was squandered by the billions. And, you know, I'm not even exaggerating by saying billions. I'd love to say hundreds of millions, but I can't. It's billions. You know, this has been one of the big problems. And Afghans have realized that. They say, where is all this aid money we keep hearing about? Many villages in the countryside have seen absolutely nothing of international aid except for, you know, the small NGOs that come in and work with them. And that's been one of the big problems.
Well, I think many people all over the world today could understand what it feels like to watch a very wealthy group of elite people become extremely wealthy, and yet their security and family lives are just deteriorating in every possible direction that they look. I just want to recommend again, Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through 3 Decades of War in Afghanistan by Edward Gerardet. Edward Gerardet, thank you so much for joining us and for spending this remarkable time. It's been very educational for me.
Thank you so much. Very kind of you. Thank you.
Journalist, author, and producer Edward Gerardet has written for a wide variety of publications on humanitarian, media, and conflict issues, including the Christian Science Monitor, National Geographic, the International Herald Tribune, the Financial Times. He's also written reports on international aid operations. His previous books include Afghanistan, the Soviet War, Somalia, Rwanda, and Beyond, and Populations in Danger, a Médecins Sans Frontières report, as well as Cross Lines, Essential Field Guide to Humanitarian and Conflict Zones. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Our music is by Fritz Heed.